Hello, and welcome to the City of Stirling Seaside Audio Walk. You've downloaded the walk that follows the path from Scarborough Beach North to Trigg Beach, and you should be standing close to the playground at Brighton Beach. The distance for this walk is about 1.5 kilometres and should take around 3/4 of an hour. There are plenty of benches along the way if you want to rest. In fact, I'd encourage you to take your time and look around while you listen to the history of the people and places described for you. There are 8 parts to this walk. When each finishes, you'll receive directions to the next landmark. When the directions are finished, you'll be asked to press pause and move to the next landmark. Just to make things easier, when each story is finished, you will hear a bell. That's the signal to press pause and move on. Some parts are quite close to each other and the directions are simple, but others will need a turn on the footpath. Please make sure you have plenty of water and wear sunscreen and a hat, especially in the summer. Europeans began settling in this area in 1829, but the Whadjuk Noongar people have inhabited the area for more than 40,000 years. As you take the walk, remember you're on Aboriginal land and please show respect. Before you set off, look around you for a moment. Take in the Rendezvous Hotel looming over the beach, the development on the promenade, and imagine for a moment that you fell asleep on Scarborough Beach in 1970 and woke up a couple of minutes ago. You rub the sand from your eyes and struggle up the path, go to the top and look about. Are you in a state of panic? You ought to be. Nothing is what it was when you fell asleep. The old scruffy seaside with its milk bars, cafes and surf shops, the sound of pinball machines at Gay Gordon's, the Scarborough Hotel, the Holdens, Valiants and Taranas crammed into the car parks, the fairground music emanating from Luna Park, the crowds along the promenade, pink zinc spread over noses poking out from under terry-toweling hats, all gone. Scarborough Beach has been thoroughly transformed in ways that Perth, Fremantle and older suburbs like Subiaco have not. For over 50 years, from the end of the Second World War to the 1980s, Scarborough was more than a beach suburb. It was the centre of youth culture in Perth, from the Snake Pit, where the Bodgies and Widgies hung out in the 1950s, to the surf scene in the 1970s, Miss West Coast and Hoadley's Battle of the Bands, Scarborough was the place to be. On this audio walk, you'll be taken back to those days. You'll hear about the famous and the infamous associated with this strip of Perth, about some magical places that have vanished, and perhaps a couple that have gone and won't be missed. Which internationally famous rock star lying on the beach here in the mid-70s looked about and commented to a friend, "The people here really have their shit together." Keep listening and find out. But for now, press pause, then walk across the grass to the kiosk about 100 metres away, where you'll hear a history of the beach. Long beaches of white sand, good enough for cricket pitches, and then the breakers, curling over green, white, foam-crested, and roaring their invitation, "Come and play with me, come and play with me." This somewhat overheated description comes from the West Australian Worker, January 22, 1915. At that time, Scarborough Beach Road was a rough, unsealed track. A dashed hard road. As for the seaside, one small wooden shack where the picnicker can buy anything necessary from a toothbrush to tinned meat was the only sign of commerce, apart, that is, from the actual signs advertising beachside views for £20 a quarter acre. If you came out here at that time, there was a plank road from Nookinbora, as Innaloo was called. Otherwise, you would have needed to park the car or horse and buggy and walk over the dunes. When the herring, the tailor, mulloway and salmon were running, fishermen camped out here. Otherwise, it was likely to be deserted. But if it was still undeveloped, Scarborough's potential had been recognised since the 1880s, when the first plans to build the road out from North Perth were set in motion. Beach culture, as we understand it, didn't really exist. At accessible beaches like Cottesloe, British custom was followed. Men and women would have bathed in separate areas. They changed into knee-length costumes in portable wooden shacks and not swum so much as stood about in the water. Even by the 1910s, when the reporter from the Westralian Worker turned up, beach culture wasn't really a thing. And what you might call the seaside happened up on the promenades, where photographers, theatre troupes and impressionists plied their trade. That would all begin to change in the 1920s. Australian actor and swimmer Annette Kellerman was probably the person singularly responsible for advocating swimming for health. But it was also important that where a Briton could be cold and grey in summer, in Perth and Sydney, even the winters were better than that. At the height of summer, people would move down from Midland and Armidale to the coast. A distinct beach culture began to develop. By the late 1930s, where you see the Rendezvous Hotel, there was a line of tea rooms, the Delphi, Webb's, Waters Rinaldi's, Goldfinch's, and behind them, an open-air dance floor. In the 1940s, kids used to play cricket on the roads around Scarborough, confident they'd only see a car every hour and the bus twice a day. Incidentally, Scarborough was named in the 1880s, after Scarborough in Yorkshire, at that time the largest resort town on the Yorkshire coast. That Scarborough may get its name from a Viking raider and settler named Thorgil Skathi, whose surname Skathi meant hare lip. Now, walk to the end of the car park, where there are two showers. There's a bench nearby if you want to sit, and hear about a hotel that was at one time the hippest place on the planet, so far as international rock stars were concerned, and what happened when the world's greatest band crossed swords with the police. You can't see the White Sands today. It's behind the block of apartments, and it's known as the Indian Ocean, a three-star hotel with the White Sands Tavern at the front. Soon after it was built in the early 1970s, the White Sands became the hippest place to be seen in Perth. For international bands who toured Perth, and there weren't that many of those, the logistics of flying band plus entourage plus equipment were intimidating. The White Sands being so close to the beach was the place to stay. So they did. The two most infamous were Led Zeppelin in 1972 and the Rolling Stones in 1973. On tours that the Australian press regarded as visitations from the underworld. At that time, Perth didn't have a performance venue large enough to hold a crowd for the two biggest bands in the world, so they played at Subiaco Oval. While the Oval could hold the people, it couldn't contain the sound. When Led Zeppelin played, people in Shenton Park and Wembley started angrily calling the police and their local MPs. Meanwhile, outside the Oval, fights were breaking out. According to the West Australian, February 17, 1972, many of the people who were unable to buy tickets to the concert climbed fences, cut holes in the fence wire, and pulled gates from the hinges in an attempt to join 5,000 people already inside the ground. The 500 violent protesters outside the Oval continued to throw rocks till the police arrived. The band finished the gig, went down to their limos and were driven back to the White Sands, maybe unaware of what had been happening outside in the streets, and maybe thinking that was pretty much standard behaviour wherever they played. The police thought differently. Around 8:30 in the morning, bearing in mind the band didn't get to bed till around 4 or 5, detectives raided their rooms searching for drugs. Lead guitarist Jimmy Page was outraged. "They came into our rooms and started abusing us. They were very rude," he said. He said he was sick to death of authorities asserting arbitrary power. He'd experienced riots before, and it was always the police who provoked the crowd, he said. "I thought we could get away with this sort of thing out here. I'm just dumbfounded by it all. We just didn't expect anything like this to happen in Australia." The police recorded names and addresses, but apparently left without taking further action. For local bands, the White Sands was an essential venue, especially the Sunday session from 5 to 8pm, when local bands like Dave Hole, the Elks, Last Chance Cafe and the Beagle Boys closed off the weekend that had started about 48 hours earlier. Press pause and walk along the path, past the pool on your right, then the modern tower overlooking the beach on your left. Stop there and listen to the stories about Luna Park. You can't see Luna Park either. It was demolished in the mid-70s, though the name survives as the shopping mall beside the Coles store. It opened on November 25, 1939, with bumper cars, flying boats and other rides, and soon became the place to be on a weekend. Dances were held, a troupe of skaters from Melbourne, the Flying Askles, performed there. On weekends over summer there were beauty contests and a bike racing track was built. One of the most vivid accounts came from the Workers' Star, the Communist Party of Australia newspaper, in January 1940. A blaze of neon lights, a medley of raucous sounds and garish colours, the writer began. Then, each booth, and there were hundreds, had a shouting, sweating attendant urging the crowd to try its luck, skill or strength. Here you may read for one penny your fortune or your character and get a picture of your future wife, husband or baby. Another penny will show you a miniature movie while you turn a handle. Dart throwing, archery, pyramids, a shooting gallery, a duck pond, etc. costs the competitors an entrance fee, which, if successful, rewarded him with an indifferent or worthless prize, ranging from a cheap bottle of hair oil, a box of toffees or a garish piece of Japanese crockery. Performing monkeys will entertain you behind a curtain, shutting out the crowd who have not paid an entrance fee. It was all too much for the reporter, who thought fondly of the Soviet Union with their children's theatre, parks of culture and rest, sports organisations and May Day celebrations. Still, he wasn't the only one looking askance at Luna Park. Like White City, another fairground on the Perth foreshore, it attracted the attention of wowsers, who claimed it was a hotbed of gambling and other vices. At one point, the chair of the road board had to intervene, investigate and report back that, contrary to rumours, there was nothing untoward going on at Luna Park. Scarborough wasn't the only beach in Perth with a Luna Park. There was one at Cottesloe and another down at South Beach. But in a way, the one here was the biggest and has always excited the most nostalgia. That's because Scarborough was really the centre of beach culture in Perth. People went to Cottesloe or Leighton to swim or lie around, but Scarborough was about fun, and sometimes that offended all the right people. Now press pause and walk to the skate ramp, just up the path before you reach the small hill. We're standing beside the skate ramp known as the Snake Pit, but I'm going to tell you about the real Snake Pit. The infamous one, up near West Coast Highway, by an old milk bar known as the Cool Corner, with capital K's. In the 1950s, an American ex-serviceman known around the beachfront as Big Don started selling hamburgers outdoors and rigged up a jukebox. It became a place to hang out in Perth, and before long, teenagers were turning up from Fremantle and Midland to dance to Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry and Elvis. People remember the Snake Pit as being a scene for fun. There was very little trouble, but because it became associated with bodgies and widgies, a moral panic developed. Who were these teenagers? Who, if some of the media was to be believed, held the city in a grip of fear? Bodgies were rockers. Their standard outfit was black jeans, black t-shirts, and black desert boots, usually with bright pink or green laces. The widgies were their girlfriends, dressed in jeans or skirts like American teenagers of the time. In the 1950s, journalists described the insidious, pernicious influence of the bodgy cult, responsible for the wide range of offences committed by boys admitted to reform schools. Yet, when you read between the lines, a lot that teenagers got up to then would hardly raise an eyebrow today. According to people who were there, the Snake Pit got its name because people looking down saw a mass of writhing bodies, like a nest of vipers, I suppose. And there are still nights when elderly people in leather jackets and gingham skirts turn up to bars and halls in the suburbs. A thumping bass announces Bill Haley's Shake, Rattle and Roll, and the Snake Pit comes alive again. We're now going to take a walk past the Whale Playground and up the hill. Just over the top, you'll see a cement path leading towards the beach. It will take you to a small ramp where you can sit, and if the waves are happening, you can watch the surfers. And I'm going to tell you about another notorious resident in the area. As you walk along the path, you can't fail to notice the warning signs about snakes and sharks. The chances of seeing either are slim, but if you do see a snake on the path, it's most likely a dugite and extremely venomous. Stand still and wait for it to move on. Don't try and hurry it, though once the snake becomes aware of your presence, it will probably do that at lightning speed. If you have a dog, make sure it's on its leash and keep it a safe distance, more than 2 meters away. If the dog decides it wants to take on the snake, there'll be one winner, and it isn't cute and furry. If there's a shark about, in all likelihood it will be far enough offshore not to present a threat. And that's assuming it's a white pointer, a bull or a tiger shark, the only three species that pose a real danger to people. Other sharks seen on this coastline, such as bronze whalers and grey nurses, are not considered dangerous, although you're advised to get out of the water if one is nearby. I've talked to people who surfed at Scarborough for 20 years and never saw a shark once. Even though fishermen say they're out there in the gutters, the deep channels just offshore where the backwash from breaking waves gathers. In the 1930s, fishermen like John Alver used to exhibit sharks they'd caught at Scarborough. Of course, they caught them 3 miles offshore, but the spectators didn't need to know that. Recalling her childhood in Scarborough, Amelia Finch used to pay threepence admission to the surf club to see the sharks lifesavers had caught. Times have changed. In WA, great whites, grey nurses, makos and several other species are protected, and public opinion is coming around to the idea of protecting all sharks. Certainly, they're a critical aspect of our environment, and overfishing will have unforeseen impacts on a fragile ecosystem. Still anxious about going in? Here's two stories that tell you something about how we behave and how sharks do. The first is from the Daily News, January 17, 1935. Last Sunday's shark scare at Scarborough, which caused amusement among bathers when a shag flew from the scene, has now taken a surprise turn. The large black object seen by the towerman, V. Donaldson, and other members of the life-saving patrol has been proved by a local fisherman to have been a large turtle which he'd been trying to catch that day, said Mr. Ashdown, captain of the Scarborough Surf Club. And this is from the Kalgoorlie Miner, December 28, 1952. Encouraged by finer weather, the largest crowds of the Christmas holiday period attended metropolitan beaches today. At Scarborough, about 4 p.m, the lookout man, Jay Holland, sounded the shark siren, clearing the water for about 15 minutes when the intruder was seen about 100 yards from the main bathing area. After cruising around, the shark made it out to sea. Not every dark shape out there is a shark, and not every shark is interested in you. Feeling better? We're now walking towards Trigg. Stay on the path, cross the bridge over the underpass and at the car park, walk down to the corner at your left. You'll see two shower stands and a small bike rack and a sandy path leading to the beach. When you get there, walk along the sand till you have a good view of the water. We're going to watch some surfing. If you went to the Sunday session at the White Sands in the early 1980s, you might have seen Midget and the Farrellys, a band named after Midget Farrelly, Australia's first world surfing champion. The classic era of surfing in Australia lasted from the mid-60s to the late 70s, when Farrelly, Nat Young and others were at their peak. When Trax magazine was essential reading for the surfing counterculture, when Golden Breed was the fashion label, and the car park at Scarborough was filled with brightly decorated Holden panel vans. But surfing in Australia has a much older history. In 1914, Hawaiian Olympic swimmer Duke Kahanamoku travelled around Australia giving surfing exhibitions. Joseph Banks saw Polynesian surfing when he was a botanist on Captain Cook's expedition in 1769. By the 1920s, tourism marketing boards were producing posters of men and women surfing on Australian beaches. The first surf shop at Scarborough was built in 1930. a decade before the road out from the city was sealed. And in October 1939, not long after Britain declared war on Germany, the West Australian was describing Scarborough as Perth's own Waikiki. Especially does it appeal to the youth, who desire the thrill of the wave chase on boards that may become dangerous, but in the hands of the skilled adds spice to the choice of a holiday at Scarborough. The long, open and shallow coastline and scattered limestone reef system from Margaret River to Durian Bay creates ideal conditions for surfing, though Perth has always been protected from the massive swells further south. Once Scarborough Beach Road was sealed in 1939 and the coastal road from Swanbourne to North Beach, that became known as West Coast Highway, was developed in the 1940s, the stretch of beach from Scarborough to Trigg was opened for everyone. Not only were there the waves, which were regular, if seldom that large, but the culture developing around Luna Park, the Snake Pit, the Scarborough Hotel and the White Sands, Cool Corner and Gay Gordons, not to mention the development of suburbs, along Perth's northern corridor, made Scarborough the heart of Perth's surfing culture. Former Channel 9 cameraman Steve Matthews started surfing at Scarborough in 1963. He recalls some of the surfers who ruled the waves back then. In the 1960s, one of the standout Scarborough surfers was Murray Smith. His family home was right on the south end of the beach. He was a goofy footer and fearless. I once saw him out by himself surfing massive left-handers at South Point Kawarumup. I couldn't believe anyone would tackle such big waves alone. Even from a distance, I knew Murray's distinct, powerful style. Another brilliant, goofy footer was Robin Skullcap Sutherland. He would take on any size wave and make it look effortless. In the early times, the stretch of sand from Scarborough North to Trigg Island formed a long, curving bay. Halfway along, exposed rocks, surface called Thrupney Reef, provided a nice wave. Trigg Point was always crowded on a good day. Over time, the building of big car parks on the primary dune system impeded the natural flow of sand that created the various banks necessary for good surfing waves. The sand then built up against the high beach wall, and some of the best waves disappeared. Murray Smith became an Australian champion surfer and runs a surf shop in Osborne Park. Notice what Steve says about the way development has changed wave formation, hence surfing. That's something known among older surfers who remember when Scarborough had a much wider beach and the waves were bigger. Murray Smith himself says that missing the early storms that regularly appeared in April has changed the movement of the sand, so the winter surf isn't as good. Okay, back to the main path now. We're going to walk past the Surf Lifesaving Club and the canteen. Past the change rooms, and with the car park behind us, we have a good view of the rocky outcrop we call Trigg Island. Trigg Island is that outcrop of limestone on the beach, which occasionally is surrounded by enough water to look like an island. The island and the beach are named after Henry Trigg, superintendent of public works from 1839 to 1851. The period when the success of the Swan River colony depended upon infrastructure, like roads, sewerage and hospitals. Trigg's surviving legacy can be seen at Rottnest, where he oversaw construction of the settlement intended as a prison for Aboriginal people. But we're not interested here in Henry Trigg so much as the island or outcrop named after him. You'll recall earlier Steve Matthews talking about how the construction of car parks altered the dune system and change the quality of the surfing. Oceanographers have known for a long time about the sensitivity of coastlines to development. Wave formation, dune erosion, plant systems are all affected. But Trigg has always been special. While there are several named beaches running south, Scarborough, Floreat, City Beach, we can also think of it as just the one running between Scarborough and the reef system at the southern side of Swanbourne. The outcrop is the northern edge of that, and for decades, fishermen have recognised it as a unique feature on the coastline. Even if they weren't aware of how it worked, or, like true fishermen, they had theories that didn't always need facts. The outcrop guards a blue hole. The best way to think of a blue hole is that, like a sinkhole on land, a thin crust over a bubble in the reef system gave way, perhaps thousands of years ago, creating a section that plunges down very suddenly. This has had a dramatic effect on currents. And at the next stop, I'll tell you about some of the drownings. But for now, we need to know that fish love blue holes. The deep water attracts a variety of shelf life, such as seaweed, limpets, and crustacea. Look south along the shore and try to imagine a colony of mussels or even an octopus surviving without any protection from predators or the weather. But they can thrive in a hole like this one. One fisherman in the 1960s estimated that over the course of a year, he had pulled over a ton of tailor and mull away from the hole. If the fishermen didn't understand the science, they still knew that trig was dangerous. Freak waves, not especially big but capable of knocking a man into the water, were always a risk. In the 1950s, local fisherman Lionel Melbourne built a 3-metre-high tripod that would allow him to sit and fish from above the breaking waves. The idea caught on, and there could be 20 people fishing from tripods around the island. For a while, tripod fishing was something you'd see at Trigg and nowhere else in Australia. For our last stop, we're continuing up the path, about 100 metres, to a small lookout with a view over the ocean on our left and the grass park behind us. There's a plaque there, and when you arrive, I'll tell you about a local hero. This area around Trigg Island is well known as dangerous to swimmers. Early on, there were a number of drownings and near deaths here, as swimmers were trapped in rips or washed off the rocks. You may remember the Australian band The Mixtures, who had hits in the early 1970s with In the Summertime and the Pushbike Song. They came to Perth on a tour in 1978, and their bass player, Chris Spooner, was washed off the rocks and drowned. Here's just a few episodes from the 1940s to the 1950s where swimmers found themselves in trouble. November 1940, two men rescued. October 1946, man rescued. May 1947, two brothers drowned. March 1950, body of a man recovered. In February 1954, two rescued, and a week later, four rescued. The most famous tragedy took place on July 19, 1947, when a group of nuns visiting from Ireland went down to Trigg to bathe. The section they swam in, still known today as Nuns' Pool, was supposed to be safe, but the blue hole is unpredictable, and one of the nuns, Sister Chrysostom, was dragged out on a rip. Two of her sisters alerted a passing driver, Fred Floyd, who ran down to the water and dived in. He swam out to Sister Chrysostom, but though he managed to reach her, the rough surf exhausted him. There were two passengers in the car, Fred's son Don and a friend of Fred's, Frank Leake. Leaving Don to keep an eye on his father, Frank drove off to get help. John Alva, the shark fisher we heard about earlier, was one of the first on the scene. But by then, neither Fred Floyd nor Sister Chrysostom could be saved. This is an account of what followed from the Sunday Times on July 20 the next day. With the rain failing on their black robes, two nuns knelt in the sodden sand and prayed beside the tarpaulin-covered body of Frederick Floyd, the man who had died trying to save the sister whose body was still in the sea. Quietly they got to their feet and walked with their tear-stained faces back to the road. Heroic Frederick Floyd was not of their faith. He was a Presbyterian, but in the great bond of human love, barriers of creed are swept aside. One of the sisters put it simply, "We are so worried about his poor wife and family. He himself is already enjoying his reward in heaven." By the way, the first in that list of rescues and drownings mentioned just above, when two men were rescued at Trigg in November 1940, their rescuers were Fred Floyd and his brother Dick. This memorial to Fred Floyd was unveiled in 2018, after a campaign by his surviving family. When you look about at the various monuments to corporate excess and political mismanagement on the seafront, it's good to find one to someone deserving. So that was the Scarborough to Trigg audio walk. But before we go, remember at the beginning I talked about a famous rock star in awe of the people at Scarborough? That was Lou Reed, a man whose best-known songs were about people struggling to get their act together. Don't forget, there's another audio walk at Stirling around Herdsman Lake from the Discovery Centre to the Settler's Cottage. And on that walk, you'll hear a lot more about the Indigenous history and the native flora and fauna in the area. Thanks for listening. This project was funded by the City of Stirling.